today on Against the Grain. Can or should we talk about the Anthropocene without talking about Africa? What's happening there in terms of environmental phenomena and human activity that deserves our attention? I'm CS. Stanford historian Gabrielle Hecht discusses mining residues, environmental damage, the dumping of dirty fuel in Africa, and much more, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Toxic waste ought to be avoided. We want to, we need to, keep it at a safe distance. But what if we can't avoid it? What if it can't, or isn't, squirreled away and stashed somewhere where it won't affect us? According to Gabrielle Hecht, waste and detritus aren't just leftover residues from some industrial mining or other process. They are also often active agents wreaking havoc and doing serious damage to human health and the environment. Hecht's focus is on Africa, a place, she contends, that too often gets ignored by pollution scientists and left out of discussions of the Anthropocene. In a recent article, Hecht writes that the Anthropocene manifests differently in different bodies. Those differences, along with the histories that generated them, matter a great deal, not just to the people who suffer from them, but also to humanity's relationship with the planet. Gabrielle Hecht is an historian and Frank Stanton Foundation Professor of Nuclear Security at Stanford University. The author of Being Nuclear, Africans and the Global Uranium Trade, she recently wrote two articles that caught my eye, one titled The African Anthropocene, which appeared in the online magazine Eon, and the other titled Residue, published on the Somatosphere website. When Gabrielle joined me recently in studio, I asked her what it meant that our planet has entered the Anthropocene.
The Anthropocene is a term that's been proposed by earth scientists, geologists, and other people who study the earth system to designate a new geological era in which human effects on the planet have reached a geological scale. That is to say, that human activity affects the material composition of the planet from its rock layers to the biosphere, the atmosphere, the pedosphere, which is the soil of the planet, and that the effect of human activity on the planet is going to be legible as a geological stratum thousands of years from now, so that if humanity even exists in 10,000 years or 20,000 years, and if there are still geologists, they would be able to see the damage that humans had done to the planet or the effect of humans on the planet in the stratigraphic layers of the planet.
So it's not just what humans have done to disrupt the Earth or change the Earth. It's literally the addition of materials to the planet's, to the surface of the planet.
Yeah, one way of thinking about it is that human activity, particularly in the industrial age, is beginning to turn the planet inside out. So the amount of mining, the kind of mining that has taken place is taking rock from, you know, deep in some layer somewhere and extracting it, so leaving holes, of course, and opportunities for new ways for water to move through the rock and other substances as well. And those raw materials, so-called raw materials, then get turned into stuff. So there's, you know, at least two ways in which the stratigraphy of the planet is affected, one by the digging and the second by the conversion of all of these different kinds of rock, these different kinds of minerals into stuff that then gets used often in an ephemeral way by people and then discarded. So that the amount of rock being extracted and stuff getting discarded is accumulating in exponential ways.
And thus your interest in human-generated waste, right? Waste, detritus, stuff that's been used and discarded. How, I mean, is there any way to describe the impact that waste has on the planet?
Well, one soundbite that you might see circulating a lot when people talk about the Anthropocene is that in any given year, humans move more rock than all natural and geological processes combined. So more than, you know, you take erosion, sedimentation, lava flows, human beings are moving more of that material than the planet itself would be left to their own devices. So that's one way of thinking about the scale at which this activity is taking place. Of course, a lot of it's not just about rocks, right? I mean, when you think about fossil fuels, which do originate from within the Earth, they're the, you know, the detritus of dinosaurs, if you will. You know, that stuff is being used, you know, obviously all around the planet as fuel, as plastic and all these things. And but then also gets released into the atmosphere. So it's not just the composition of the planet's soil and rock layers that's being changed, but also the composition of the atmosphere via the release of CO2, of course, but all kinds of other particulates as well.
You found quite striking the cover of the journal Nature in March 2015. Could you describe what that cover shows?
So the cover, it's a beautiful graphic in many levels. The cover shows a male torso, and you see this male from approximately nose level down to approximately waist level, I believe. And drawn on this white man, fit young white man, is a jumble of images, some of which are represent plant life, organic activity, beautiful things, and others of which represent industrial activity and waste-making practices. You know, the cover, that issue of Nature was devoted to the Anthropocene and to various debates that scientists are having about the Anthropocene, and you have all different kinds of scientists involved in this question, and that's part of why it's an interesting category. You know, so the content of the issue is about when did the effects of human activity really begin to have an impact on Earth on a planetary scale? And there are different theories for this. And then various other aspects of Anthropocene science. You know, what's really striking about that cover is that it is the title of the issue is The Age of Humans, I believe. And here you have an instance in which this white, fit white man is the stand-in for all humanity. And that impels, you know, a very strong critique that you often hear of the Anthropocene concept, which is that it's all very well and good to say that humanity has had an impact on the planet, that human activity has this impact on the planet. But the fact is that it's not all humans. Not all humans have the same impact, right? Some humans have had a much stronger impact than others. You know, obviously the forces of capital are huge in this story as well. And in discussions of the Anthropocene, very often the people living in parts of the world that actually are going to be the most affected by climate change, by toxic waste, and all of these places are actually left out of the equation. So it's almost like they're part of the us who is affecting the planet, but they are not part of the us that needs to deal with the consequences.
And the inclusion, or in this case, I guess, the exclusion of Africa from many discussions around the Anthropocene, could that be seen partly as a reflection of the fact that Africa does not have a large ecological footprint as compared to, let's say, the global north, which tends to use a lot more, for example, fossil fuels per capita?
What I would say about that is that the exclusion of Africa from a lot of Anthropocene discussions parallels the exclusion of Africa from a lot of other conversations as well, be these political conversations, be these scientific conversations, social science. You know, there is a level at which Africa kind of remains in the public imagination, the dark continent, the place that we can't know, that isn't part of the we, that is somehow excluded other. And much as you know, hundreds of scholars and intellectuals of all kinds from Africa and who write about Africa have fought against that exclusion, it's still baked into our systems of knowledge production. So a lot of Western capitalist activity in Africa has contributed mightily to the Anthropocene. but the benefits of that activity have not then gone back to the places where these raw materials come from and the places that get polluted in the process of producing these raw materials. So there's a really important way in which the wastes of the Anthropocene get hidden away on the African continent and thereby remain invisible to the people who are looking at their shiny, clean, beautiful iPhones and not really thinking about where the coltan that makes it all work comes from and who produced it and what the land around those mines is left looking like now.
Raw materials extracted from Africa include, of course, minerals. How important to the Anthropocene are minerals in Africa and their extraction and their movement?
Well, they're crucially important. So gold, the largest, deepest gold mines in the world for a long time were in South Africa. That is actually how South Africa came to be an industrial nation. And also, you know, starting as a colonized territory with all the exploitation that we are familiar with as we think about the history of colonial and then apartheid South Africa. And this gold really, you know, I mean, this was the gold of the gold standard, right? This was the gold of the second industrial revolution. This was the gold that, you know, the financial system that we know today is where that gold came from. And there are obviously other gold producers in the African continent, but that's just one example. So, you know, so that's hugely important. Another mineral that I've written about a lot is uranium, the stuff that fuels nuclear power reactors and nuclear weapons. In any given year of the Cold War, something like between 20 and 50% of the capitalist world's uranium came from the African continent, from South Africa, from Namibia, from Gabon, Madagascar, Niger, Congo. So the so-called nuclear age was very significantly fueled by African minerals. And, you know, those uranium mines are left today, you know, in a state that is very difficult to remediate, if that's even the right word.
Gabrielle Hecht is my guest. She's a professor of nuclear security and of history at Stanford University. She joins us to talk about two articles she's written recently, one titled The African Anthropocene and the other titled Residue. And we'll get into residues of what later this hour. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Now, this mining in Africa, and I guess in South Africa, industrial gold mining began, as you wrote, in 1886. So it's been a long, long time. Obviously, that mining required labor, required human labor. What was involved there in terms of people migrating to the mines to work and the costs to their bodies and their health and their well-being over the years?
Hundreds of thousands of young African men migrated from all over southern Africa to work in the South African gold mines. Some of them were recruited. So the Chamber of Mines in South Africa had a recruitment arm that it would send out to what is present-day Mozambique, Zimbabwe, really all over the southern part of the continent. And young men would respond to these calls for a number of reasons, one of which was that the colonial state in all of these places was demanding taxes from African residents. And the only way to pay taxes was to get wage labor. And so you had this kind of evacuation of villages and of the agricultural sector, if you will, with young men migrating to mines in southern Africa. So really, over time, you know, I don't know what the total number is, but at any one given time, for example, in the 1920s or 1930s, you might have 400,000 young men working in these mines. So we're talking really a lot of people. And the dangers in these mines, which were the deepest and the hottest mines in the world, were extraordinary, right? I mean, this is all the ordinary dangers that you might expect from mining, like rocks could fall on you and injure you or kill you. So that was a very frequent occurrence. Then there's the dust in the mines. So silica dust in particular, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these young men end up with silicosis. And when they go back to their homelands, as they were called, or to their villages, to their to places where they live, they're left there without medical care. So it turns out, you know, it's their families who care for them and who deal with the after effects of the work on the mines. And these young men would migrate, and the typical contract was a 9-month contract, and then they would go back to their homes for 3 months and then re-enlist. But part of what that meant was that the mine managers could sustain this fiction where these young men were only working for 9 months. So what harm could possibly come to them in 9 months? And there wasn't any big need to follow their health status in a continuous way, right? So they would get health checks to be sure that they were fit for work, but there wasn't a kind of continuity afterwards to see what the effects would have been. And then, as it turns out, another major source of occupational exposure for these young men was radiation, radon, because in these very deep gold mines, the other mineral that was strongly present was uranium. And uranium, you know, it's a radioactive element. It decays naturally. And when it decays, it produces radon gas, which is invisible and odorless. And as the radon gas itself decays into byproducts, those byproducts attach themselves to the dust that is already present in the mine. And the miners inhale this. And then those radioactive particles, radioactive alpha particles, they just stay there, you know, being radioactive in these men's lungs, which, of course, combines with the silica that is also in their lungs and all the other harm, and produces, in many cases, but not all, because it's a stochastic process, produces lung cancer. And that also is something that was not studied. In fact, it was actively not studied by South African scientists under apartheid, who had repeated opportunities and invitations to conduct extensive studies in their mines from the international scientific community. And they would conduct these pilot studies and then say, you know, because there were also white men working in the mine. So they would conduct these pilot studies on the white miners, and then they wouldn't find lung cancer, often because not enough time had elapsed, but also sometimes because white miners often were put in better ventilated places in the mine, and those better ventilated places, you would just, you know, have less radon exposure. And the conclusion of these studies over and over again under apartheid was, oh, well, you know, there's nothing is showing up among the white miners. So there's, and the black miners are only coming here for 9 months. So, you know, what's the big deal? You know, there's no need to conduct further research. So you have, you know, all the normal but still very serious dangers of mining. And then you have this additional exposure that these, you know, hundreds of thousands of men faced. And that, you know, also is not being followed or come to terms with in any significant way.
Now, with these gold mines, rock is being brought to the surface and gold is being extracted from the rock. And you write that there was a fair amount of rock whose gold content could not be extracted profitably. What happened to that rock?
So that rock is just put into tailings piles. And this is a standard practice of the mining industry. You have these tailings piles, and some of them can get very large. I mean, they look, you know, like small mountains. Tailings are mine waste, basically. That's what the industry calls them. And so, you know, the waste piles up on the South African Witwatersrand Plateau, also known as the Rand. You would have next to the shafts, with all the rock that miners brought up, you would have, you know, these piles of waste rock that would just grow higher and higher and higher. It's not that these piles, these tailings piles, had no minerals in them. It's that the bits that, as you said, could not be treated profitably at the time. So, you know, what the chemical process was for extracting gold in 1930 was not what it was in 1960, for example. So, you know, a lot of these tailings piles contained pretty significant amounts of gold still, but equally important, they contained significant amounts of uranium. And before the 1940s, there was no need for uranium.
Okay, so these waste piles, these massive piles of tailings, contain uranium. When did uranium become attractive to governments and states, and why? And what happened then to these huge pyramids of content of waste material from these mines?
Uranium first came on the global radar after 1945, right after the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And as the arms race, the nuclear arms race heated up between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and as other nations such as Great Britain and France also became interested in developing nuclear weapons, there was an initial worldwide race for uranium. This started pretty much immediately after World War II. The U.S. for about 10 years got a lot of its uranium, 10, 15 years, got a lot of its uranium from the Congolese mines that were part of the Belgian Congo under colonialism. But the U.S. also immediately started looking for uranium in other places. And from previous metallurgical assessments, they knew that a lot of these tailings piles in South Africa contained uranium. So, in fact, the first 10,000 tons of uranium that South Africa exported to the U.S. and the U.K. for their nuclear weapons programs, 10,000 tons came from these tailings piles.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Gabrielle Hecht joins me. She's Frank Stanton Foundation Professor of Nuclear Security at Stanford, where she is affiliated with the Center for International Security and Cooperation and the Department of History. She's author of Being Nuclear, Africans and the Global Uranium Trade, and The Radiance of France, Nuclear Power and National Identity After World War II. How important was water to the mining of gold in South Africa?
So water is crucial, and it was particularly crucial in the gold mines on the Rand in two ways. One was that as the mines went down deeper and deeper, they went below the water table. So the tunnels would get, the shafts would get flooded if the water wasn't pumped out. So the first really big thing that had to happen was to pump all of this water out as the mining was taking place so that workers could go down and continue to extract rock from the rock face. And so we're talking about massive quantities of water here that's getting pumped out. And then water is also very important to the processing of the gold, the chemical processes that extract the gold from the rocks, or that extract the uranium from the rocks for that matter, and the treatment processes. So you have an immense amount of water that's being pumped out of the aquifer, and then an immense amount of water that's being used in these chemical processes and that, you know, basically gets turned into wastewater, because once you're done treating the rock, you have to do something with this liquid that's left that is not exactly drinkable.
Right. And so what would happen to the water as a result of being in contact with the rock down in these mines?
What happened, this is a kind of process that happens over time. So while the mining was very active, the water would get pumped out. But over time, starting in the late 80s and picking up in the 90s, and then especially in the 21st century, these mines got worked out. And so they started shutting down. And as they shut down, then there's no longer a need to pump water out because the mine shaft is not active anymore. And so a combination of the water table rising and rainfall and various other hydrological processes meant that the shafts, the empty shafts, were getting filled up with water. But this time, these shafts, you know, this rock was now exposed rock, and the water would react with the pyrite in the exposed rock and become very acidic. And this is known as acid mine drainage. And this is not unique to South Africa. You find this in many, perhaps most, mining configurations of this sort. So this water, this acidic water, would flow through the shafts and, of course, into the aquifers and into agricultural land and all of these other places. And the problem with this acid water wasn't just that it was acidic, which is, of course, not conducive to plant life or to human consumption, But also that the acidic nature of the water made it a better host for heavy metals to dissolve in the water. So then the water also became a carrier for metals such as arsenic, lead, you know, uranium, of course, but lots of other things that we all recognize as toxic heavy metals. So that this water that is now, they call it on the Rand, they call it decanting when you have water that suddenly kind of gushes up and flows out onto a field from a mine shaft. And, you know, these tremendous gushes of water that happen. It's not just acid water, but it's also water laced with these heavy metals. So it's contaminated in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of ways that are quite difficult to clean up.
What effect have these surges of water onto the landscape had on the health of people who live nearby and who perhaps eat crops grown on these fields?
Well, it's had a tremendous impact on the agricultural areas where the water is flowing out. It does mean that there are lots of people who don't have access to clean water. It makes it more difficult to get access to that clean water. The problem with identifying specific impacts on human health is that you would have to conduct, you know, complex epidemiological studies, which the South African state is not in any position to conduct. So it's quite difficult to posit clear cause and effect scenarios, especially because it's not just the water that's contaminating people's food, but also the ongoing dust that's being blown from tailings piles that still exist.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So there are these huge tailings piles. Are they visible? How big are they? And yeah, what happens when the winds pick up?
Well, some of them are visible from many miles away. And so one place that I visited was right in the shadow, in the wind shadow, if you will, of what is often said to be the largest of these tailings piles, the largest one in the world. And the winter in South Africa is July and August, of course, because it's the Southern Hemisphere. And so when winter comes, the winds pick up and they blow across the tailings piles, which are not vegetated in any way, despite the effort of some scientists to work on that. But the funding for that research was cut off. And so those tailings piles are just sitting there with open rock on them. The wind blows over and it blows the dust onto whatever is in its path. And in the particular community that I visited, this was an informal settlement of about 20,000 people who were still waiting for permanent housing. It's known as the Tudor Shaft Settlement. And you have this radioactive dust that's blowing across their houses. You know, they're breathing it in. Their children are playing in it. You know, children often put, I mean, there's no child in the world who doesn't put his or her hand in their mouth. And so, you know, between the lack of access to clean water for any purpose, really, and the fact that this radioactive and otherwise toxic dust is just part of their everyday lives, you have many different sources of contamination for these communities.
And what does this say about the Anthropocene? I mean, in what way are the dynamics of the activities that caused what you're talking about, to what extent are they typical or emblematic of the kinds of human activity that has characterized or has accumulated to the point where we can talk about an era called the Anthropocene?
Well, I think they're incredibly emblematic of this era in many ways. One, just on a geological level, the kind of rearrangement of rock that this represents, and now you have these, you know, rock remnants that are inside people, right? They're inside their lungs, they're inside their bodies, they're being processed, you know, the water, everything is, you know, it's part of their organism now, permanent in some cases, a permanent part of their organism. So that's one level in which, you know, the earth, we're ingesting the earth, but we're ingesting the more toxic parts of the earth that have been made toxic. So that's one way. Another way in which it's typical is, you know, that these effects are invisible to the industries and consumers that are benefiting from the products made by this uranium or this gold or any other. I mean, you know, one could rehearse the same story for many other kinds of metals as well. Economists talk about externalities, right? So, you know, and this is, I mean, this is a word that is one of the most misleading words in the English language as far as I'm concerned, you know, because an externality, that sounds like, oh, that's something that you don't have to think about very much. That's external to our process, right? But what an externality really means for an industrial process is that's something we don't have to pay for. That's something that we don't have to take into account when we produce our balance sheets. That's something that doesn't eat into our profits. That's something that we don't see. You know, so if you were to imagine the cost of, I mean, in my recent book, I talk about the cost of nuclear power, but, you know, the cost of anything, right? If you were to imagine how much that price would increase if you actually took into account the health care for all these folks, the effects on agricultural land, you know, the need, I mean, South Africa is experiencing major water problems right now. Cape Town gets all the buzz these days because they're approaching day zero,
of a drought,
right? Which really, just parenthetically, the buzz about that is, you know, really what that means is that suddenly now white people might be in danger of having to access water in the way that black people in South Africa have been accessing water for many, many decades now. But that's an aside. The Rand is an extremely dry place. So having, you know, all of this water be unusable is very, very grave situation. So all of these effects, which are systemic effects, right? I mean, they interact with each other. You know, it's a dynamic system that's constantly changing. But not taking any of that into account when you think about the goods to which you as an American citizen, as a middle-class American citizen, let's say, have relatively easy access to, all the cheap stuff that we can produce that sustains our middle-class existence is cheap because these kinds of effects are not being counted into the price for us or for the companies that produce them. And I don't want to suggest that you only find these effects in Africa. Of course not. I mean, you find them here in the United States, where there's a clear pattern of environmental injustice amongst communities of color. But you find these effects in China. You find these effects in Latin America with these huge lithium mines. I mean, the African case is not unique by any stretch of the imagination, but it is emblematic, and it is perhaps a case that gets less attention than others.
Gabrielle Hecht, she is professor of nuclear security and professor of history at Stanford University, and I want to talk with her more about her work after this short break. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Gabrielle Hecht, H-E-C-H-T, is Frank Stanton Foundation Professor of Nuclear Security at Stanford University, where she is affiliated with the Department of History. Her books, again, include Being Nuclear, Africans and the Global Uranium Trade, and The Radiance of France. So you referred earlier to kind of this toxic dust being blown around and entering the lungs of many people in Africa, in South Africa. And I want to turn to air pollution of a different kind, vehicle exhaust. So you have this oil, and much of it does come from Africa, like in the Niger Delta, which a lot of people have heard about. How impactful has oil pollution in the form of exhaust been?
Well, so part of the issue is that there are not very robust studies done of air pollution in African cities. But just like those pictures of Beijing and Delhi that you see with people walking around with face masks because there's soot hanging in the air, there are numbers of African metropolitan areas that also feature these same problems. They just don't make it onto the news in the same way. One thing that I started getting interested in this about a year and a half ago when I read a report that had been produced by a Swiss NGO called Public Eye, where they began to suspect that the actual diesel that was going into African engines had higher levels of particulate matter in it than the diesel that would feed American engines or engines in Western Europe. So they began to do some tests on sulfur content, and they discovered indeed that the sulfur content of these diesel fuels was sometimes 10 or more times the standards in Europe and the United States. In one case, they found a sulfur content that was 600 times more than the maximum standard for Western Europe and North America. What's happening here, what they found, is that you have these commodities brokers like Trafigura, which made the news a decade ago with a gigantic spill off the Ivory Coast. So commodities brokers like Trafigura, Vital, a bunch of others that are buying fuel, some of it produced in the Niger Delta or other offshore zones in Africa, some of it produced elsewhere. And then mixing this fuel with waste streams from other chemical plants so that you have a much dirtier, more contaminated fuel that's cheaper, of course, because it has all this garbage in it, and then reselling that to African countries like Senegal, Ghana, Angola, etc.
Is that illegal?
Well, no, in the sense that many of these countries did not have a sulfur standard. So if there's no maximum limit on what the sulfur content can be, then it's not illegal. It is, however, arguably immoral, since there's a pretty good reason for that sulfur standard. And in fact, some countries have, as a result of this report, begun to establish standards for sulfur content. But, you know, of course, sulfur is just one of the contaminants that you can find in this fuel. There are many others. And one thing is to establish a standard, and the next thing, another thing is to figure out how to enforce the standard. And enforcing standards is an incredibly costly proposition. So it's certainly possible, it seems likely, that we'll see some improvement in the situation as a result of this report becoming public and gaining quite a bit of news, and the UN Environment Program is finally starting to notice pollution in Africa, which it apparently wasn't really noticing very much before, certainly did not have any programs to combat urban pollution previously. So, you know, there may be some improvement on the horizon, but there's still a very long way to go.
You said earlier that there hasn't been a lot of research into urban pollution in Africa. Why is that? I mean, is it just a matter, you think, of people not taking Africa too seriously in the scientific community?
I think that's certainly part of it. And the fact is that, you know, the world bodies that pay attention to these kinds of things have been much more focused on Asian cities than they have been on African cities. And I don't want to second guess why that may be true, but one suspects that a lot of the stereotypes of Africa are at work here. One of those stereotypes is that Africans are mostly a rural people, even though African metropolitan areas are growing at the fastest pace of any metropolitan area in the world.
How concerned is the World Health Organization with air pollution in Africa specifically?
The World Health Organization has come out very strongly to declare that urban air pollution is the biggest environmental contaminant that people are faced with. Until recently, they had no programs to deal with this in Africa. I don't want to say that that means that they weren't concerned, but it does mean they didn't have a program. So I hear that this may be changing. I am not up to date on the latest developments there. But it is striking when you go on their website and you look at the programs that they have and you see that absence.
So you are co-editor with Pamela Gupta of a collection of papers on the website Somatosphere. This collection with the title Toxicity, Waste, and Detritus in the Global South, Africa and Beyond represents a collaboration between scholars on two continents, right?
Yeah. So the collection actually grew out of a project funded by the Mellon Foundation to rethink the African humanities. And it was a collaboration between the University of Michigan, my former employer, and the University of the Witwatersrand, which is where Pamela Gupta teaches. The mandate of the collaboration, which is still going on, is to kind of think about all the different ways in which humanistic inquiry can be further developed on the African continent, but also in ways in which studying phenomena, cultures, et cetera, social history in Africa can help those of us living in the global north think in new ways about the humanities. So that's the broad framework. And this particular branch of that collaboration was developed via a number of conferences in South Africa, sponsored, you know, by the grant and by the University of the Witwatersrand, also known as Wits University. So it included scholars from the University of Michigan, from Wits, from the University of Johannesburg, and from a couple of other American universities. And we got together a couple of times to talk about our common interest in those themes, toxicity, waste, and detritus, and how thinking about those themes from a global South, especially African, but not only African perspective, might shed light on global processes.
And what would you say to people who would say that waste and detritus, they are symptoms or after effects of social or economic development? I mean, do you agree that that's the best way to characterize it, or do you see waste having a more active role?
So what I would say is that waste is an inevitable part of any dynamic process, whether it's biological or industrial or anything. And the category of waste makes it seem as though waste is something that should be hidden away, something that we don't have to think about. It's residual, even a residual category. And the fact is that, and this is, I think, how the term the Anthropocene and the research that's been done around it helps to focus our attention on the fact that the more waste we produce, the less we can ignore it. And that this waste doesn't just sit there inert, but is very often contaminated, moves through space and time, sits there latent for a while until it comes back up again. And none of this is innocent, right? This is not something that we can say, oh, we didn't know that this would happen, right? A lot of how waste behaves can be predicted. You know, there are better and worse ways of creating tailings piles around mines, right? It's possible to create tailings piles or tailings dams, which is when the waste is in more of a liquid form, and so then you have to contain it, right? There are ways of creating those waste piles that contain them better than others. But of course, it costs money. It takes time. And waste is not a sexy thing, right? So when engineers come to design new stuff, you know, it's not many engineers, but I don't want to blame it on them. I mean, just, you know, societies in general don't value waste management in the way that they value the production of new stuff. And that is, I think, a large part of how the quantities and types of waste that we produce can have the long-lasting deleterious effects that they do have, is that their management is not valued.
Gabrielle Hecht joins me. She teaches nuclear security and history at Stanford University, where she is affiliated with the Center for International Security and Cooperation. And her books include Being Nuclear and The Radiance of France. She's also edited the volume Entangled Geographies, Empire and Technopolitics in the Global Cold War. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And you've also referred with Pamela Gupta to the slow violence of these processes. So in a temporal sense, there is a kind of violence being done, but what would you say? It's so gradual that it often escapes the notice of people who ought to be very concerned with the long term, namely with the future of the planet.
Yeah. The term slow violence comes from Rob Nixon, who's a professor of English now at Princeton and who wrote a book entitled Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor. So I just want to be clear that that's his term that we find immensely productive. And the idea behind it, I mean, so here's an example from the nuclear weapons domain. So when pundits talk about nuclear weapons and, you know, want to emphasize how harmful they are and how terrible a nuclear war would be, right? There's a lot of discussion of what would the effects of nuclear war look like. And so you can spin out all of those immediate effects. And war is violent, very obviously violent in an immediate way, a fast way, not a slow way. A nuclear explosion is obviously extremely violent in a very immediate, fast way. And so a lot of the discussion over time has been around that. But the fact is that nuclear weapons have already produced tremendous environmental destruction in the United States, in the former Soviet Union, any place that uranium is mined, you know, any place that components of these weapons are manufactured. There is a long legacy of radioactive and toxic contamination. You look at Hanford up in Washington, the state of Washington, is the biggest Superfund site in the country. Funding for cleaning it up has just been reduced. So, you know, the point that I like to make to the nuclear security folks is that, yes, I mean, of course, I mean, nuclear war would be terrible. I'm not suggesting that it wouldn't be. And we should be thinking about what that would look like. But we shouldn't let that stop us from paying attention to the violence on the environment and on people's health that the production of nuclear weapons has already wreaked. And that is slow violence in the sense that it doesn't show up right away, right? You don't get, you know, if you were living in Hiroshima within the blast radius of the bomb, then you would see these immediate effects, right? I mean, we've all seen these images of skin peeling off as a result of exposure to gamma radiation. So you know what that violence looks like, and that's easily identified as having been caused by the atomic explosion. But the part where the people making plutonium buttons for nuclear weapons who work with these fancy gloves in glass cases, and, you know, it seems like they're protected, and then 10 years later, they get brain cancer, you know, that's a much slower process. Still very clearly attributable to their work, but it doesn't show up for a long time. And sometimes it doesn't show up until after people have stopped working in this environment. 10 years is actually pretty quick for a cancer to show up. You know, 20 years, 30 years might be more typical depending on the level of exposure and the type of exposure. So that's where that idea of slow violence comes in. And you can see it in all kinds of domains, not just the nuclear one.
So we've been talking a lot about processes involving waste and residue and pollution with effects on human health, on the environment. And I wonder if you want to kind of sum up your analysis. We've been talking about Africa. We've talked about how Africa generally isn't brought into discussions of the Anthropocene. What would you like to see happen around discussions around, you know, human impacts on the environment, the way humans are changing the planet, to incorporate African people, African environments, African activities? What would your ideal sense of the incorporation of Africa into this discourse be?
What I find useful about the Anthropocene as a concept is that it can federate lots of different types of thinkers. So it can be a way to bring together natural scientists, social scientists, humanists, artists, engineers into a discussion of how to cope with the planet that we have created and are continuing to shape. And I just think that that conversation can't possibly be complete. It cannot move forward unless we incorporate lots of different kinds of people from lots of different places into the discussion. So, you know, the very first thing I would say is we need to bring African intellectuals into this discussion, right, of all of these stripes. That's very important. But also, you know, that we need to be looking at places all over the world, right, that we can't assume that the impacts in North America or Europe are the same as the impacts elsewhere, right? The impacts of climate change are very different for an island nation, and the temporality of that impact is very different for an island nation than it is for a continental mass, and, you know, and so on. So that if Anthropocene conversation and research is to have the reach that it deserves to have, it needs to make an active effort to include lots of different kinds of places and to understand how the Anthropocene has been and continues to be an engine of inequality and what that means in terms of natural processes, economic processes, political processes. I should say that I am by no means the only person thinking about the Anthropocene in African contexts, and there are, of course, plenty of African intellectuals who are thinking about this. For example, my colleague Leslie Green, who teaches at the University of Cape Town and who is visiting at UC Santa Cruz this year, has a project on environmental humanities south where she's really trying to figure out what, you know, how the Anthropocene looks like from African perspectives, looking less at the kind of toxic waste kinds of issues that I'm looking at and more at agriculture and other kinds of issues around water and fishing and environments, so that there are many possible approaches to this, and they all need to be encouraged and brought into a bigger global conversation if that conversation is truly to be global. It's not global unless that happens.
Gabrielle Hecht, Frank Stanton Foundation Professor of Nuclear Security at Stanford University, a professor in the Department of History as well there, and we've been talking about two articles she's written recently, one entitled The African Anthropocene, which appeared and appears in the online magazine Eon, A-E-O-N, and the other titled Residue, published on the Somatosphere website, which also features a whole collection of essays on toxicity, waste, and detritus in the global South, Africa, and beyond. Thanks, Gabrielle, for your work, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with UCS.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.